Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. On Tuesdays and Thursdays, we talk apologetics and theology. We find ways to better understand our Catholic faith and find other ways to use our Catholic faith to better understand the world around us, including when our faith intersects with ideas in popular culture, which we'll talk about today with the issue of anti-racism. Before I continue, though, as I said on Tuesday, I'm really excited because Council of Trent episodes going forward are all going to be on YouTube, and it won't just be video of me. I'll have PowerPoints, video clips. I'm really excited about this because a lot of the episodes of podcasts that I listen to, I don't listen to them as podcasts. I listen to them on YouTube. So I'm really excited to share this. And if you want to help us to grow on YouTube, if you're listening on the podcast, be sure to go to YouTube, click subscribe. If you're watching this on YouTube, click subscribe to be able to help us. Also, consider going to trenthornpodcast.com. For as little as $5 a month, you get access to bonus content. Our Catechism Study Series debuts every Monday at 8 a.m. If you're a silver level subscriber or higher, you get a fancy mug. You can submit questions, message me. A lot of great stuff. Be sure to go to trenthornpodcast.com for that. All right, I want to talk about the issue of anti-racism. This is something that has been talked about for a few years now, though it's been a lot more prevalent since the protests about race relations in our country over the summer after the killing of George Floyd. I noticed today that there was a clip on Cartoon Network dealing with the subject of anti-racism. So it's three characters marching along, and they start singing a song about how they're colorblind. You know, we don't see black or white or purple, and one of them's like a purple alien. But then they stop the song and say, hey, wait a minute, what is this song actually teaching us? So I'll play the clip for you to see what I mean.
Colorblindness is our game because everyone's the same. Everybody join our circle. Doesn't matter if you're
white or black
or purple.
What the? Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Hold up a minute here. Who wrote this? I think it kind of does matter that I'm purple. I mean, I'm purple because I'm literally an alien.
Well, I'm not an alien, but it definitely matters to me that I'm black.
Yeah, it makes a difference that I'm white. I know the two of us get treated very differently.
I just think it's messed up to compare me being an alien to you two being different races. You're both human. You're totally biologically the same. Adding purple people into a lesson about human racism makes no sense.
Yeah, that is pretty weird. I think people like the black, white, or purple thing because adding a fantasy race in there helps distract from the actual racism black people have to deal with.
Right. My experience with anti-black racism is really specific. Other people of color experience other forms of racism too, but you won't see any of that if you don't see color.
Dude, so this entire public service announcement could be a ploy to avoid talking about racism altogether.
Now, if you're not familiar with anti-racism, you might wonder what they're talking about here. For many people, most people would say they're not racist. If you ask people, are you racist? They would say, no, I'm not racist. And a lot of people, what it would mean to not be racist would mean to judge other people, as Martin Luther King Jr. said, not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. So they would seek to be colorblind, to not even notice that people are of a different race or a different ethnicity. But those who promote anti-racism would say that's not enough. If you don't notice that people are black and white, that there are racial, not just that there are racial differences, but there are racial disparities, and if you don't work to combat those disparities, you're part of the problem. Or some of the authors put it very bluntly, if you're not working to combat racial disparities, you are a racist. It doesn't matter if you don't have malice towards a certain group. They would say you are actually racist because of your inaction towards things like racial disparities, and that saying you're colorblind is a form of racism from their perspective. So there is a lot I could have talked about in this episode. I mean, this episode is probably going to go long as it is, but it could have been many parts. There's a lot of things I can't cover. So just as a brief disclaimer, the limits of this episode, I'm not going to be able to talk about critical race theory or philosophy of race or social movements like Black Lives Matter. I'm just going to focus on the question, what is anti-racism, to the best of my ability here in the single episode. I'll talk about the church's position on racism, and then my personal position and thoughts on the positive elements in anti-racism movements and elements that I think are more concerning when it comes to these particular movements. The primary source I'm going to draw from, now I have looked at other articles, watched lectures, read excerpts from other books, but the primary source that I'll be drawing from to understand anti-racism is Ibram X. Kendi's book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. Though I will admit, it's ironic, of course, that anti-racists will say it's racist to treat entire groups as monoliths all the same. And they're absolutely right. So much the same among anti-racist advocates, you're going to get a lot of different kinds of people. I'm sure there are people who identify as anti-racist who disagree with Ibram X. Kendi on some things or important things. So I'm just doing my best to try to read what I think is one of the most popular texts on this subject, and then look at the principles as well as the principles that other people share, things that I consider to be positive, things I consider to be concerning, things like that. Let's talk, though, about Catholic teaching on racism. The Catechism says in paragraph 1934, created in the image of the one God and equally endowed with rational souls, all men have the same nature and the same origin. Redeemed by the sacrifice of Christ, all are called to participate in the same divine beatitude. All, therefore, enjoy an equal dignity. So we're all equal, created in the image and likeness of God, regardless of what race, ethnicity, or nationality you belong to. Paragraph 1935 of the Catechism goes on to say, the equality of men rests essentially on their dignity as persons and the rights that flow from it. And this next part is quoting Gaudium et Spes, which was written in the Second Vatican Council in the midst of the civil rights movement in the U.S. So it says, every form of social or cultural discrimination in fundamental personal rights on the grounds of sex, race, color, social conditions, language, or religion must be curbed and eradicated as incompatible with God's design. Though this teaching against racism goes before the Second Vatican Council, one of my favorite illustrations of it can be found in the encyclical Mit Brennender Sorge. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. It was a papal encyclical written in 1937, smuggled into Nazi Germany, authored by Pope Pius XII, and its goal was to speak against the Nazi state and the racism that it promoted. So this secret encyclical brought into Nazi Germany, read from the pulpit, said, whoever exalts race, or the people, or the state, or a particular form of state, or the depositories of power, or any other fundamental value of the human community, however necessary and honorable be their function in worldly things, whoever raises these notions above their standard value and divinizes them to an idolatrous level. So it's fine to be proud of your culture. It's fine to be proud of your nation. It's not okay to be a racist and think that your race is fundamentally superior to others and other races are not made in the image and likeness of God. Or to think that your country is somehow exempt from the law of God that has been given to all countries. Whoever divinizes them to an idolatrous level distorts and perverts an order of the world planned and created by God. He is far from the true faith in God and from the concept of life which that faith holds. So this would include, of course, racism. We'll be talking a lot about anti-Black racism, but racism would also include anti-Semitism and any other kind of prejudice against any particular group of people, whether it's Asians, people from the Latino community, or racism against whites or Caucasians. Now, some people say that's not possible, which is a source of dispute even among anti-racism advocates. So we'll talk about that later. But even going back further, way beyond the 20th century, go back to the first century. St. Paul writes in his letter to the Galatians, there is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither slave nor free. There is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. And if you are Christ, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to promise. The Judaizer heretics in the first century said, the Gentiles, they're not real Christians because they're not Jews. If you're not a Jew, you're not a real Christian. And Paul said, no, you can be a good Jew and be a good Christian, but you don't have to become a good Jew first. You don't have to be circumcised to be a good Christian. Christianity is open to all ethnicities, Jew and Gentile, to all social classes, slave or free. It is universal because Christ died for all of us. He provided a universal atonement so that all people could be saved. So that's a brief look at Catholic teaching on racism. What is anti-racism? Well, Kendi defines racism as a marriage of racist policies and racist ideas that produces and normalizes racial inequities. So it's not a great definition because it has racist in the definition, but it's essentially policies and ideas that produce racial inequities. Notice that the definition is not focused on the particular attitudes a person has, such as having a malicious hatred towards another race or devaluing another race. That's because it's very broad. You could be completely ignorant of racism, and you would be a racist simply because you are not combating racial inequities. So Kendi's very clear. You either are racist or you're anti-racist. An anti-racist combats racial inequities. A racist does not combat them, either through acting to create the disparities or sustain them, or through inaction, not trying to reduce these kinds of disparities. So it's very focused more on outcomes we observe rather than personal disposition. So what are some of these disparities? And they are important to look at, and some of them are quite troubling. We look at household median income, for example. The average for races is about $61,000. Whites make about $68,000. Asians, about $81,000 for median household income. But Hispanics only make $50,000, and Black households make a median income of $40,000 a year, which is about $21,000 below the national median income. So there's a disparity here, and that's troubling, because if you have less income, you're more likely to be in poverty, you're not as able to flourish, and of course, we want all people to be able to flourish. So what do we do to help people in these difficult situations? Well, we first have to acknowledge that poverty in the situation exists, and then figure out, well, what do we do about it? Another example would be home ownership. The average home ownership rate in the United States is about 65%. These graphs, by the way, come from an article in USA Today. Whites own, on average, about 73% of whites own a home. The lowest group are Blacks. They have a home ownership rate of only 44%. And that also is troubling for human flourishing, because a home is a very important asset. It's a very important wealth-building tool, not just for yourself, but also for your children as well. And so one reason that this disparity exists is because of very pernicious racist actions that took place in the past that have enduring effects to today. And it makes sense that we should do our best to try to remedy these kinds of disparities. However, so that would be those people who don't think racism is a big deal. It is a big deal, even if we don't have certain kinds of past elements of racism today, their lingering effects still exist, and so they need to be combated. On the other hand, those who would say they're very much anti-racist should be concerned that in trying to address these disparities, you might actually be making them worse through unintentional effects of the policies you promote, which we'll talk about here in a sec. The last one, here's an example of four-year colleges. The average rate of completing a four-year degree is about 60%. Asians, it's 74%, whites is 64%, but American Indians are at 39%, and Black Americans are at 40%. So we have these disparities. What do we do about them? Before I continue, though, I think the big question is, should Catholics be anti-racist? And I think the answer is pretty obvious. Yes, but there's always a qualifier, right? Yes, we should be anti-racist, just like we're anti-abortion and anti-poverty. But we can reasonably disagree with one another about how to combat poverty and how to combat abortion and how to combat racism. Some people think you're not truly anti-abortion, for example, unless you only support laws to ban abortion with no exceptions whatsoever. But you can certainly be anti-abortion and promote laws that allow exceptions, like in the case of rape or incest, if the reason you're doing that is because you believe that is the only law that is feasible, the only one that can be passed into law, and a total ban is just simply not possible. So we're going to disagree amongst one another, but that doesn't mean we have the right to say you're not really anti-abortion because you don't believe in my prudential judgment about how to get rid of abortion. Much the same way, we can't say, well, you're not really anti-racist because you don't believe in my prudential judgment about how to get rid of racism. We're going to disagree about those things. So I think this should be clear. Obviously, racism is evil. We should combat it, whether it is personal racism in the hearts of men, the lingering effects of racism from the past into the present, or current social structures that promote and perpetuate racism. So I'll talk about all of those, but we should combat those. But we're going to disagree about how to do that. So let me talk then about what are some of the positive elements of the anti-racism movement. One positive element, I think it forces us to confront how widespread racial bias is. I mean, we're all sinners. It's funny. Some people say, well, I couldn't possibly, I don't have a racist bone in my body. Well, we're sinners. I mean, we're tempted to, you might say, well, I would never commit adultery. I would never murder somebody. But we still have desires towards sexually impure things, towards malicious anger, which Jesus said is as bad as murder. So even if you're not going to be a frothing at the mouth racist that hates another group, you could have a disordered desire towards a racial prejudice or a racial bias. We should be aware of these biases, just like we're aware of all of our other biases and all of the other strings that the devil tries to pull to get us to sin. There's a wide variety of them. We need to be aware of them so we can combat them and so we can treat all people as being made in the image and likeness of God. And there's a lot of interesting studies that show the widespread nature of racial bias in areas we may not have thought of before. There's a 2004 study by Bertrand and I think it's Melanathan, and it's about job applications. The study is called, Are Emily and Greg More Employable Than Lakeisha and Jamal? A Field Experiment on Labor Market Discrimination. So what they did is they took job applications and sent them out to different employers. Some of them had more traditional white-sounding names like Emily or Greg, and then others had more traditional black-sounding names like Lakeisha or Jamal, although the applications are all the same. When they did the follow-up, they saw that the white names had a 50%, they were 50% more likely to get a call back from the employer than the black names. So I think that is evidence of a racial bias that may be quite present. And this racial bias, if it's something that is widespread and is unchecked, it can stifle flourishing of our black brothers and sisters so that they're not treated in the image and likeness of God. And so that's concerning. However, there was a recent follow-up in 2017 from UCLA. There was a study there that looked at the names and saw actually that it really does depend on the kind of black name you choose to get the particular outcome. They said that there are some, the guy who did the study in 2017 looked at registry birth data on black names and compared them to social and economic groups. He found, for example, that among lower income African-American women and families, their one of the most popular names for lower income families was Deshaun, whereas a common name among African-American families with more means, upper class or middle class, were names like Bria. And what the study noticed is that people had a hard time with the black names of the upper class detecting that they were black, whereas the lower income African-American names, people had an easier time identifying them as black names. And so the applications, the callbacks, it's interesting there. You can look at it different ways. You can look at it in one way that it's really a bias against income rather than race. That could be a part of it, but I still think race is a part of it. It just shows that blacks who have been successful have unfortunately had to use techniques such as hiding one's blackness to be able to succeed. And this is unfortunate. And this is something on a personal level, I can understand because my surname, my last name, should be Hornstein. It's a Jewish name. But my grandfather got beat up in World War II for being a Jew, so he changed his name from Hornstein to Horn. And there's a lot of Jews, actually, who changed their names to hide their ethnicity. Hispanic families have done that as well to kind of normalize and assimilate. And so it's something to confront that people should be allowed to flourish and prosper regardless of what their names are, what their heritage is. Another positive element is, and I believe in putting a balanced treatment here, by the way. I would say there are positive elements, like with any movement, even the anti-abortion movement. There are positive elements and there are negative elements. I will tell you, there are negative elements in the anti-abortion movement. People who are blowing up abortion facilities, that's very concerning and negative. With the anti-racism movement, I would say there are positive things and things that I find to be concerning. So I'll continue with some more positive things. Another one is reckoning with the enduring effects of racism. Remember I showed in that example about home ownership, blacks only constitute 44% of black families own a home. One reason for that is that in the 20th century, blacks are prohibited from owning homes due to redlining laws. This is an old, I think it's an FHA map the Federal Housing Association. And it talks about different security risks, about giving people mortgages. And the areas in red were considered high risk, and so mortgages were often denied. And why are they high risk? Well, let me see my notes here. The ones that might be like blue or green, you would say, well, these are safe because they're homogeneous. What does that mean? But the red areas, they would say, the red areas have, one of the manuals from 1936 said, they have an infiltration of a lower grade population. Or one housing manual said homes should not be sold to, quote, inharmonious racial and nationality groups. So this redlining prevents African-Americans from purchasing homes. And that has a cascading effect that if you're not able to buy a home, you're not able to build up wealth. And a lot of people who have bought homes, like I used to live in San Diego, California. There are a lot of homes there that were built like in the 30s or the 40s or the 50s. People bought them there cheap in the 40s and have left them to their children. And now there are people in San Diego sitting on $700,000 homes they barely pay any taxes on because they just inherited them from their parents or their grandparents, and they're taxed at a lower rate because of something called Prop 13. But you see that it takes, and sometimes when it comes to building wealth in a family, it's a multi-generational process. So if Black Americans were undercut by that with redlining in the 1930s that prevented them from acquiring homes, then that puts them further back from the starting line. And so that's something that needs to be addressed. However, it doesn't mean every single way to address disparities in homeownership are a good idea. For example, just giving people loans, no matter what their credit history is, in order to encourage them to buy a home, let's say because they're African-American or from another disadvantaged group, you might say, well, we'll give you a loan. We're not going to worry about your credit history, your risk. Well, that's not good. You could hamper that person, because what if they get into a situation where they're in over their head with their mortgage and they're unable to pay it and they're financially worse off for being given this particular kind of loan? So once again, you can notice the disparities, but not every solution to the disparity is going to be a good one. We also need to come, the anti-racism movement, I would say, is also good because it helps us come to grips with the diabolical evil of racism. When we think about racism, it's an abstract term for people, like how abortion is an abstract term. When I used to go and give talks on abortion for Justice for All, we would do a presentation where we snap people out of complacency by saying, we show people graphic images of abortion so that abortion is not a word anymore. And in 1955, people used graphic images of racism so that racism would not be a word. If you're watching this on YouTube, I'm going to show you, this is a graphic image of Emmett Till, a boy who was lynched by whites outside of Money, Mississippi, because he was accused of whistling at a white girl when he went into a store. And so this is his body they found. It's graphic. I'll show it to you. And he was so disfigured. His mom purposely had an open casket funeral so the world would see what the men did. And the men were put on trial, by the way, and after 45 minutes, they were found not guilty. So, I mean, this is clear, unadulterated, evil racism. It's something, this kind of racism, I think our culture has. So it's clear, unadulterated racism. So I think that it's important that I appreciate the anti-racism movement for helping to make racism not merely an abstract concept, but an evil from the devil that wants to divide us amongst one another. Another positive element that I understand, I'm torn on this one, that when someone says, look, you're either a racist or an anti-racist. On the one hand, I don't like when it's too broad brush, that someone who is burning a cross in somebody's lawn and another person who is just too busy with their life and they don't really think about racism, to say they are moral equivalents, I don't think that's very helpful. And I think it could also even have a negative effect and make people feel like, well, who even cares? If I'm racist, no matter what I do, who even cares? But on the other hand, I appreciate the anti-racism movement saying that inaction can be something that's bad. If there is an evil like racism and you're inactive and you don't do anything to combat it, then you're part of the problem. I'm not necessarily opposed to that kind of thinking. The letter of James in scripture, James 4:17, it says, whoever knows what is right to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. One of my favorite classic pro-life or abortion books, pro-life book, is by Richard Exley. I think it was written back in the 90s. It was called Abortion, but I love the subtitle, Abortion. Pro-life by conviction, pro-choice by default. Think of that subtitle, Abortion, pro-life by conviction, pro-choice by default. Exley's thesis was that there are many people who say, I'm pro-life, I'm against abortion. But when you look at their actions are no different than a pro-choice person. They don't combat abortion. They don't vote to help put people in positions of power who will end abortion. They don't like abortion. They don't like it at all, but they're not doing anything. They may be pro-life by conviction. They're pro-life in an interior way, but they're pro-choice in an exterior way. You could never know by looking at them that they're really pro-life. And that's concerning. So that's why I would say for a lot of people who are anti-abortion, who are pro-life, what are you doing? What are you doing? And I'm not asking much. Are you willing to pray in an abortion facility? Are you willing to have a conversation with someone on abortion and tell people why it's wrong and gently engage them in dialogue? And I think the same thing is true with racism. Though, as I said, I don't like when it's done in too broad brushed of a way. All right, so those are some positive elements, I would say, of the anti-racism movement. But what are some more concerning elements? One would be seeing racism as a problem with fixed perpetrators and victims, that white people are the racist ones and everybody else is a victim of racism, but primarily black people are victims of racism. Now, it's interesting, Ibram Kendi actually doesn't believe this, so that's a good thing. But I've seen other anti-racist advocates that kind of talk about this. This is from a Canadian website here. This is a Calgary Canadian anti-racism website, and they have a whole article on the myth of reverse racism. That they say it's a myth that you could be racist against white people, for example, or that you could be racist, that or that black people, they can't be racist. And the idea here is that racism is just a kind of power, that you can only be racist if you have societal power. Minorities don't have societal power, so they can't be racist. But here's the thing. I just want to get out of these power dynamics a bit. I mean, that is important. We need to combat structural sin. We need to help people flourish. But if you are so dogmatic that you would say black Americans, for example, cannot be racist, the thing that concerns me, that kind of makes me mad, is that I am worried for anybody, whether they're white, black, Asian, Jewish, whoever they may be, I am worried for anyone that harbors sinful racist malice in their heart. That if they dwell and harbor sinful racist malice in their heart, now a lot of people will say, the anti-racism people will say, well, you can be prejudiced, but you're not racist. But they treat prejudice as like a venial sin, I guess, to use terminology. If you have sinful racist malice, I don't care what color you are. I don't want you to have those feelings. They're not good for you physically, emotionally, and spiritually. I don't want you to go to hell. I don't want to go to hell. I don't want anyone to go to hell because they have malicious hatred towards their brother because of their brother's race, regardless of what their brother's race is or what their race is. That is what concerns me. And if we think that racism is only something white people can commit, then we have a problem. Then we have a problem with anyone is capable of falling into this evil of this evil hatred, and the devil would love to get you to think you can't be capable of a certain sin. So it's definitely a problem. But as I said before, Kendi actually doesn't believe that. He says about the argument that minorities can't be racist, he says, you have black people who believe that they can't be racist because they believe that black people don't have power, and that's blatantly not true. Every single person on earth has the power to resist racist policies and power. So this is from a CNN interview. And actually, Kendi says, look, if you say black people can't be racist, you're racist because you're saying blacks are not capable of doing something that everyone else is capable for. So I appreciate that. But what I don't appreciate is when he says things that he's in favor of things like anti-racist discrimination, that a lot of people would say, well, we don't want racism. We don't want unjust discrimination. We want everyone to be treated equally. And Kendi would say, no, we actually shouldn't treat people equally. We should do whatever it takes to get rid of racial disparities. So he writes in his book, if discrimination is creating equity, different than equality, equality would be giving everybody an equal opportunity. Equity is ensuring equal outcomes regardless of the choices that people make, which is really impossible to do because people have different desires and temperaments. But let me just continue in the quote. If discrimination is creating equity, then it is anti-racist. If discrimination is creating inequity, then it is racist. So it's not that discrimination is right or wrong based on the kind of discrimination, whether it's against a race or not. We would say, you know, you might say, well, discriminating against an unqualified person is good. Discriminating against a person because of their race is bad. But Kendi would say, no, it's about what does the discrimination accomplish? If it fixes equity, it's good. If it increases equity, it's bad. That's why he says the only remedy to racist discrimination is anti-racist discrimination. The only remedy to past discrimination is present discrimination. And I disagree with that. I would say, no, you can harm other people, even people who you would say have a lot of power. Look at the previous racial disparities. Actually, one of the groups that has some of the most power and flourishing in the U.S. are Asians, or at least particular Asian communities, where there are high median household incomes. There are high rates of acceptance into colleges, for example. That is why there is a case, a lawsuit you should be watching. We might hear from it soon from the Supreme Court, actually. It's Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard. It's a group that is suing Harvard University, saying that Harvard discriminates against Asian applicants. It says here, a review of over 160,000 applications to Harvard University found that if academic achievement alone was the only measure used to determine enrollment eligibility, Asian Americans would make up 43% of Harvard students, even though right now they only make up 19%. So why aren't there more Asians at Harvard University, even though they have all the grades and the test scores to make it? It indicates that administrators rated Asian Americans lower on criteria like personality and likability. So even if you have the grades and the test scores, you go to the interview, he's not the kind of person that would fit in here. And I would say that's racism. Imagine if you did that to an African American student. Or 70 years ago in Ivy League schools, they had quotas on the number of Jewish students you could have in the school. That is racism. The answer to racial disparity is to not tear down people who are flourishing. It's to bring up people who are not flourishing, who need that kind of a help. So when it comes to things like affirmative action, I understand that if you have two equally qualified candidates and one is from a disadvantaged background, you might give the edge to them. And that makes sense to me. Like, if we were going to hire an apologist to Catholic Answers, and we had a male applicant and a female applicant, and they're both essentially equal in their education and their accomplishments, I would say we should go with the female applicant because she brings a range of experiences that the Catholic Answers apostolate doesn't have because the apologists are all men. I would say we should bring in an apologist of color as opposed to another white apologist because they bring an experience we don't have, provided everything is all relatively equal. If someone is simply not qualified for the position, I'm not going to give it to them, whether they're white, black, Jewish, female, whatever it may be, because it would just harm. I mean, I can't give anyone a position. I'm not in charge of anything. But if I were, I would say you shouldn't give positions to people that are not qualified. But among qualified candidates, you can give an edge to those who are from disadvantaged groups or underrepresented groups. But the problem here is that you have people who are making the grade who are being held back by arbitrary and unfair standards. Now, the federal courts have dismissed this. They've appealed to the Supreme Court. It'll be interesting to see what happens there, though. Another concern I have is the overemphasis on structural sin over personal sin. I can't remember where Kendi puts this in how to be an anti-racist, but he essentially says that it's not about what's in your heart and the ideas in your mind and then the actions that flow from that. He says that that's backwards. For him, it's basically racism is caused by structures that create these racist outcomes. So we have to change the structures and that will change the outcomes. But I would say, look, if you've got racist bias in people's hearts, you can change the structures. The bias is still going to show up in things. So you should remove objectively sinful structures, Jim Crow laws, laws that prevented blacks from voting, South African apartheid laws. So obviously there are sinful structures. But if you reduce it to just that, that's a problem. This is actually a page from a book Kendi wrote with a co-author called Anti-Racist Baby. It's a children's book on being anti-racist. And the core principles of an anti-racist baby is celebrating our differences. That's good. Use words to talk about racism. That's also good. Number three, understands that people aren't the problem, policies are. Now, that can be taken one of two ways. On the one hand, I agree with it if you're saying that racial disparities, if you say racial disparities are only the result of personal choices, that if this minority group would just get their act together, the disparity wouldn't exist, then I would say no, because they may be hampered by racial injustice in the past that has a lingering effect to the present. So to blame it just on personal choices and not structures, I think is wrong. But on the other hand, the other extreme is to say, no, it's not about your personal choices. It's about these structures. If we fix these structures, things would be fine. That is a problem that I have. If it is racist to say this particular community, whatever race it may be, whether it is blacks in inner city schools that are not graduating, whether it is poor whites in West Virginia that are addicted to opioids, there are things, structures you can change, things you can change in the schools, things you can change when it comes to doctors overprescribing opioid medication. But you also have to tell people, whether it's the white drug addict in West Virginia or the black dropout in an inner city school, here are personal choices you need to consider making. These choices will make things a lot harder on your life. These choices have the best chance of it not being as hard. So that has to factor into it. Actually, Pope St. John Paul II gave an apostolic exhortation, I think it was back in 1984, called Reconciliation and Penance. And he talks about how sin, there are structures of sin. Sin is something that can be in the human heart, but you can create these structures, laws, customs, whatever it may be, that can perpetuate sinful conditions. So he talks about that. But then I like this part that John Paul II says after that. He says, having said this in the clearest and most unequivocal way, one must add at once that there is one meaning sometimes given to social sin, which people also call systemic racism, structural sin. There is one meaning sometimes given to social sin that is not legitimate or acceptable, even though it is very common in certain quarters today. This usage contrasts social sin and personal sin, not without ambiguity, in a way that leads more or less unconsciously to the watering down and almost the abolition of personal sin, with the recognition only of social guilt and responsibilities. The idea here, this is like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the French Enlightenment philosopher. People are just inherently good, and society is what makes them bad. So people are good. You can't say any group is better or worse than another. If someone is sinning or committing crimes, it's because they don't have enough money, they don't have enough healthcare, they don't have enough insurance. No, there's people, you can give people all the needs in the world. The Enron executives had all the material needs they could ever have. They still committed evil. So it says here, watering down and almost the abolition of personal sin with the recognition of only social guilt and responsibilities. Practically every sin is a social sin in the sense that blame for it is to be placed not so much on the moral conscience of an individual, but rather on some vague entity or anonymous collectivity, such as the situation, the system, society, structures, or institutions. So a lot of people ask me, you know, do I believe that America is systemically racist? And I've talked about it a little bit on Matt Frad's podcast before to a little bit of controversy online. But my answer to the question would be, well, you have to define what you mean by systemically racist. I don't believe that we have laws that are on par with Jim Crow or apartheid today. I do believe there can be laws that are race neutral, but disproportionately affect certain groups. One example of this would be laws that punish crack use more than cocaine use, even though crack is more likely as a drug to be used by African Americans than cocaine, for example. However, like just a broad statement that America is a systemically racist country, when people say that to me, I am skeptical of that claim. I could see there's examples, but I want more evidence for that. And some people will say, well, here's this racial disparity, here's that racial disparity. And I'll say, okay, there's the disparity. But if there is systemic racism, that means there is something that is causing negative outcomes for racial groups that we could change. There is something that was created with the intent of causing a negative outcome for a racial group. It's some kind of policy, some kind of law. And I would say if there is systemic racism, tell me, what law do we change that is causing this to happen? And a lot of times I don't get, there's not really very specific answers on that. People will point to systemic racism And in certain groups, I think sometimes that could be answered by racial bias that is present. Not necessarily it's a part of a system, but it's a part of a bias that exists in individuals. But regardless, I would say in the question, is America systemically racist? I would say, I think there are some laws, even though they are written to be race neutral, can disadvantage minority groups. On the other hand, though, I am skeptical of broad, overly generalized claims like America is systemically racist, or even something like America is a racist country. I don't see the evidence for that, though I am open to pursuing it. I think the beyond pointing at disparities, I don't get a lot of concrete suggestions about what specific policies are the racist policies, beyond that they have a kind of unintended effect on particular groups, even though the policy has nothing to do with race whatsoever. I think that an interviewer from Vox, which is a pretty liberal left-wing site, asked Kendi, is the capital gains tax, is reducing capital gains taxes, is that racist? And Kendi says, well, if it doesn't go to stop these disparities, so yeah, it is racist. So if everything is racist, then I feel like nothing is racist. And that's a dangerous thing. We need to focus on particular concrete examples we all can agree on. For example, there was that story a few weeks ago about a cemetery in Louisiana that refused to bury, I think it was a police officer, because he was black, because there was a rule written in the cemetery's guidelines saying they didn't bury black people. Obviously, that was a rule that was written during the Jim Crow era that is now defunct. It's just been kept on the rule books for so long. So obviously, that's a more explicit example, but when people make claims of systemic racism, I am eager to hear concrete examples of these rules, how they're created and how they're applied. And I see some that are compelling, but not as many as would be necessary for me to accept a very broad claim like that America as a whole is a systemically racist country or that it's a racist country. So that's what I get concerned about, that if you define racism so broadly in this way and without nuance, I really feel like it makes a joke of the concept and it takes away the evil that is inherent in thinking that other people are less human than you and thinking that other people, not even that they're less human, but thinking erroneously that other people have more criminality or more promiscuity or, you know, thinking that other these dangerous falsehoods about other people. And to give you an example of this, this is a video of Catholic Charities CEO Rob McCann. I think he's from the state of Washington. I'm not sure, though. And it's a video where he talks about racism. This was done, I think, just a few weeks after the killing of George Floyd. And this is what he says. It encapsulates my concern about making racism this kind of weirdly universal, unnuanced idea. Here, just listen to him.
It has made me realize some important things about my own life that maybe I always knew, but never truly embraced with enough blunt truth. I am a racist. That's the hard truth. I am a racist. How could I not be? As a white person living in America, where every institution is geared to advantage people who look like me, it's seemingly impossible for me to be anything other than a racist. I know that I have routine bias, even if it is unconscious bias, as we all do. But I also believe that my bias is dangerously different. My bias, the bias of white people, supports and feeds into powerfully racist systems in our country.
Here's what I just don't get about this. That he gets up there and he says, I am a racist, but he's still the CEO of Catholic Charities. He hasn't resigned. So why can't somebody else who's a CEO of another company say, I am a racist. I think this group of people doesn't deserve to work for me. I hold them in contempt. That is who I am. If they are both equally racist, and if McCann can still hold a job and be a CEO, even though he just declared in a YouTube video that he's a racist, why can't somebody also say they're a racist and they're just a different kind of racist?
But here's the biggest problem for me. When someone like McCann gets up in a video and says, I am a racist, merely because he has a subconscious or unconscious racial biases. If that is the case, then the term racist loses all of its meaning. If you're going to equivocate, if a white supremacist is a racist and someone with merely who has an unconscious bias is a racist, then the term loses its meaning. You lose the ability, because I would ask this, is it a sin to be a racist? Is it a sin to be a racist? I think most people would say, yes, it's a sin to be a racist. But if a racist is anyone who has this bias, then everyone is guilty of the sin of racism, which isn't true. I mean, we make an analogy to same-sex attraction all the time on this point. You know, we'll say, look, it's not a sin to have attractions to people of the same sex, but it is a sin to act on it. Much the same way, it's not a sin to have racial biases, but it is a sin to act on it in order to hurt or exploit other people. So if you don't make that distinction, that's what we have a hard time seeing, obviously, in secular anti-racism, but even sometimes in religious anti-racism, saying that the sin of racism is something overt, something you are choosing to act upon, not merely having a particular bias, because our biases, inclinations, our feelings, we cannot control those. We can control whether we act on them. So it's just this false equivalency of saying that a white supremacist and someone who just merely doesn't want to take part in anti-racism efforts, they're both racist. In Kendi's book, this is what is concerning. There was another part of Kendi's book where he says essentially that the real concern are not overt white supremacists. Rather, it's the whites that say they're not racist, but through their inaction perpetuate structural racism. And I see this in anti-racism that they'll say the white supremacists aren't the real problem. It's the whites in the middle who think that they aren't racist. Like if they're worse and you can say, oh, because of this, because I haven't done enough to help the anti-racism movement, then that means I'm a racist. If McCann can say I'm a racist, I don't get it. Like imagine if somebody got up in a video for their Catholic Charities and said, anti-Semitism has been a long problem in American and world history. I am an anti-Semite. I am a sexist. You know, what if someone said these things? What if they said they were some other kind of sin? And just treat it as if this is just who I am and it can't go away because I'm white and that's who I am. Now, once again, Kendi, to his credit, he says that racism and anti-racism are more like peelable name tags. You can take racist, nope, anti-racist. Jim, I don't know, the Office reference there, that he believes it's a very mutable kind of thing. Though it is a little bit interesting that with Kendi and others, they'll say it's wrong to tell disadvantaged groups, change your behavior to make yourself better off, because those disadvantaged groups have been hobbled by decades and centuries of racist oppression and racist ideas, but they expect white people to immediately change their attitudes and behaviors when it comes to racism, even though white people, from their perspective, have been hobbled and conditioned by those same decades and centuries of racist ideas and systems. So that's another thing that I think is a little bit of a double standard there. But I just think I can't get over that video. And I can't believe it's still up, actually. It hasn't been taken down. But yeah, no, there is a difference between someone who is inattentive to an evil and someone who relishes in that evil. And if you can't make that distinction, I don't think your movement is doing well then in that regard. Another element I find to be concerning is that people will point out disparities between whites and non-whites, but only focus on the negative disparities among non-whites. But there's all kinds of disparities, and that doesn't follow that there's racism. By Kendi's definition, it's racism if two racial groups are not on equal footing. But we know, for example, that whites are more susceptible to certain kinds of diseases. Atrial fibrillation is one. It's kind of rapid heartbeat caused by poor blood flow. There are cancers that blacks are more likely to get and cancers that whites are more likely to get. So if a white person is more likely to get cancers X, Y, and Z, does it follow they're a victim of racism because they don't stand on equal footing with blacks who are not as likely to get that kind of a disease? Well, no, it should just be, look, we have different biological differences among us, and we should all band together to promote medicine. And I do believe there are disparities I'm concerned about, especially maternal mortality rates among African-American women, for example. They're very, very high. We have high maternal mortality rates in America in general compared to other industrialized nations, which is probably a subject for another podcast.
But when we use racism as a wedge instead of just promoting sound medicine for everyone, we have a problem. And also, I think a lot of these other issues where you have high mortality rates among certain populations, those are issues related to poverty and related to issues we have to address that may not all be structural racism. And that's the other concern I have, that you have the disparities, but we disagree about how to deal with the disparities. Some anti-racism people will say, well, police officers cause these racial disparities. When actually, like, you look at Minneapolis, for example, they're trying to defund the police. Minneapolis is now spending to hire more police officers because blacks in low-income neighborhoods are saying, we want the police. They kept us safe. You can't flourish in neighborhoods that are overrun with crime. And I'm sorry, your little volunteer patrol with the yellow vests that don't have guns are not going to be able to do anything, or at least do much that's productive. They might be able to help with some smaller level disputes or mental health issues. But on the whole, Minneapolis has been a failed experiment in trying to defund the police, for example. So when you're trying to address poverty, some people say, well, we don't need police. I would say actually healthy, functioning police departments that are held accountable, for their actions, not just shielded by qualified immunity and police unions and things like that. Or consider this example I showed earlier about college graduation rates, that blacks are at 40%, whites at 64%, Asians at 74%, the average is 60%. Well, what might be contributing to that? Well, part of it may be affirmative action policies that place black students, even though they wouldn't normally have the grades or standardized tests that would show they are capable of doing the work, placing them in these more rigorous academic programs where they're not able to thrive and they're more likely to drop out, instead of saying maybe college is, whether you're black or white, I don't care. I went to community college. They were always selling all of us to go to a four-year Ivy League school. I think that's bad. I went to a community college first, and that was good. And I think trade schools are good. There are a lot of people, frankly, college is a waste of time for a lot of people. Did you go to college? How much of what you learned in college do you remember today? Probably not a lot. You know, so some colleges, some programs are going to be worth it. But a lot of others, it's a waste of time and money. And it's a waste, especially for black students, for example, who might benefit from other types of vocational training, other degrees that, frankly, not just black students, but many white students. I don't care if you're white or black. Odds are your sociology degree or your BA in psychology is probably just not going to pay off. And it's not good for you. Though I will say there is a concern about for-profit colleges using deceptive tactics and fraud to lure in minorities to their programs. That is something I think is wrong that has been tackled. So that's just my thought on that. So my point is, when it comes to these vague systemic racism claims, pointing to disparities, it's not enough to prove systemic racism. I want to know, what is the specific policy we need to change? And we're going to disagree about that because we're making prudential judgments. Another issue I found really troubling in Kendi's work was a defense of cultural relativism. He calls this cultural racism. So he says, he quotes, I think this is an anthropologist, Ashley Montague. He says, he's quoting him, "All cultures must be judged in relation to their own history, and all individuals and groups in relation to their cultural history, and definitely not the arbitrary standard of any single culture," wrote Ashley Montague in 1942. Kendi talking after the quote, "a clear expression of cultural relativity, the essence of cultural anti-racism." So he goes on to say that to be an anti-racist means you have to practice cultural relativism. You can't say one culture is better than another, which is, of course, contradictory, because Kendi would believe an anti-racist culture is better than a racist culture. So he ends up endorsing cultural relativism that undermines his anti-racist project. Another concerning element is false narratives. Saying that you're concerned about overrepresentation of African Americans in the criminal justice system, which I think is quite concerning, and it's a complex question that intersects issues of poverty, racial bias among police officers and judges, demographics in the African American community, such as the absence of fathers. Absent fathers, regardless of racial groups, divorce and absent fathers, we know, regardless of racial groups, has a tremendous negative impact on children. Read my co-author Layla Miller. We wrote Made This Way together. Read her book Primal Loss on divorce. The stories are heartbreaking. And I don't care whether you're white, black, Hispanic, Asian, divorce and absent fathers are going to have a negative effect on you. We know absent fathers are more prevalent in the African-American community. And so, once again, I'm not saying that's the sole cause for the disparities, but it is a concern. So you have things like blacks in the criminal justice system. It's a multifaceted answer to the question of why that is. But parts of it, if it's just false narratives, got to cut that out. Things that are just not true have got to go. And the biggest one is hands up, don't shoot. This idea that police officers are involved in some conspiracy to kill African-American men, and African-Americans are highly disproportionately likely to be killed by police officers. I did a whole podcast back when there were more violent protests and riots after the killing of George Floyd, where I talked about how this is a myth and studies that debunk that. But one that's especially a myth is the claim about the shooting of Michael Brown. I think that was in 2015 in Ferguson, or was it 2013? It was several years ago. And the claim was that Officer Darren Wilson confronted Brown. He had just robbed a convenience store, or strong-armed it. He went in, grabbed cigarillos, and left. And that Wilson confronted him. Brown put up his hands and said, "Don't shoot." And then Wilson shot him anyways, killed him in cold blood. The U.S. Justice Department did an extensive investigation. This was under the Obama administration. Attorney General Eric Holder said, no, we interviewed 40 witnesses. And it was not the case that Michael Brown did not have his hands up. He did not say, don't shoot. He put his hands up briefly and then began to charge at Officer Wilson when Wilson had his gun drawn, aimed at Brown. So he charged at him when he had his gun up. He didn't just stand there with his hands up saying, don't shoot. That didn't happen. It's false. And most people admit it's false, but it still shows up at rallies, at protests. And I can't stand it. If you're going to make a social justice movement, it can't be built on falsehoods, because you just can't. Our foundation should always be the truth. Here's another one. I guess this is maybe my last concern with the anti-racism movement. A lot of it is opposed to capitalism, like trying to say you cannot be anti-racist unless you're anti-capitalist. And well, you just heard me on the Economic Roundtable defending capitalism. I would say that is not true. You can be in favor of capitalism, and that can be actually helpful to combat racism. But Kendi said in an interview with Democracy Now, he says, the origins of racism cannot be separated from the origins of capitalism. The life of capitalism cannot be separated from the life of racism. Now, I do not understand this. Racism has been around long before the transatlantic slave trade. Racism is a human sin. And capitalism arose in 14th century Italy by Italian merchants. Capitalism did not create racism. It didn't create a lot of the evils we see. It became a venue for those evils to flourish. Capitalism is a tool, like a knife. You can use a knife to carve a steak or stab somebody in the back. But the anti-racist advocates will say, no, to be against racism, you have to be against capitalism. And I just don't understand that. It would be like saying, in order to be against abortion, you have to be against capitalism. And I've read that. We had a roundtable, talked about distributism, socialism, capitalism on Reason and Theology. Thomas Hackett defended distributism. On his website, he has an article saying, to be against abortion, you got to be against capitalism. I would say, no, I know lots of capitalists out there who are firmly against abortion and donate tons of money to pregnancy resource centers to help low-income women. That's a good thing. That's a good thing to be able to do. Another activist, Olga Segura, who wrote a book, Birth of a Movement. She's actually Catholic. It's a book about the intersection between Black Lives Matter and Catholicism. But even she says this in an article that had an excerpt of the book. She wrote, if the church is to embrace anti-capitalism, which it must embrace in order to work toward a truly liberating Catholicism. So we see here, you can't be against racism unless you're against capitalism. And I don't understand that. Capitalism is something that is a system that can be abused, but it's not inherently abusive like racism or socialism properly defined. And no, Kendi actually says in his book, when could blacks ever compete with whites in a market? That almost sounds racist to me. You go to this is the Greenwood District of Tulsa, Oklahoma, on a very bad day. The Greenwood District of Tulsa, Oklahoma had a lot of flourishing black businesses. In the 1910s, it was called Black Wall Street. Very prosperous. Then after there was an allegation that a black black shoe shiner assaulted a white elevator operator, Tensions brewed, and there was eventually a riot, and the whites in the town burnt down Black Wall Street, burnt it to the ground. Now, I would say, no, this the fact that they were able to flourish and thrive was evidence of capitalism. And capitalism's fundamental tenet is private property rights. Under capitalism, you can own your business, and your business is yours. The government cannot take it away from you without serious justification and compensation. Other people can't take it from you. That if people try to take your business away from you by stealing from it, by burning it down, that you can get the police to come and protect you. That is, if you don't have private property rights, when you look at other parts of the world that lack private property rights, you find, and lack capitalism as a result, you find poverty. You find black poverty. Go to Africa. There's a wonderful book by Greg Mills called Why Africa is Poor and What Africans Can Do About It. And he talks about how socialism made sub-Saharan Africa poor and keeps it poor. He talks about Kenneth Kaunda, the leader of the National Party in the nation of Zambia. And so Mills writes, Kaunda's socialism has created a civil service geared to protectionism and regulation at all costs, and a private sector attuned to working within a system that rewards insiders and discourages independent entrepreneurship. We should not underestimate the fact that this system, a feature of most African countries, works just fine for the elite. So, and what was really ironic is when I read Kendi's book, he says, well, I'm anti-capitalism, but then he says, well, why is there so much crime in black neighborhoods? And he says it's racist to say it's because black men are more likely to be criminals. And I agree that is racist. He says, no, crime is associated with unemployment. And there's higher unemployment. And when you don't have a job and you have nothing to do, you're more likely to go out. You're more likely to commit crimes. And so he writes this passage. He says, anti-racists say black people, like all people, need more higher paying jobs within their reach, especially black youngsters who have consistently had the highest rate of unemployment of any demographic group. And I would say, well, I agree. Let people start businesses. Give them the resources to be able to do that. Free up discrimination that or racial bias, keeping them from acquiring capital, from getting investors. But the answer is capitalism, is letting people work, letting people set up businesses, letting them take risks. When you try to level everything out through the hand of government, if you're worried about structural racism, it's the same with socialism. It's this idea that I don't trust regular people to not be greedy or to not be racist, but we need the government to come in order to make things equal when it comes to money or race. But government is made of people. And when you give government power, it's more likely their implicit racial bias will make things worse, actually. So those are just more of my concerns. There's more that I could have discussed when it comes to this. So just to re-summarize, can a Catholic be an anti-racist? Yeah, well, they should. We should be against the evil of racism. Should they? Yes, but you're going to have to use your own judgment about what is the best way to combat racism. There are things in the formal anti-racist movement that I agree with and I think are positive, and things that are frankly concerning. And you'll find that with any social movement. And so I think it's important for us to be fair when looking at these different movements, and especially when it comes to elements of them that critique our faith. It's one thing for an anti-racist movement to be bad at getting rid of racial disparities. My bigger concern as a Catholic is if it reduces the sin of racism to just a social justice goal of removing racial disparities. We ought to improve people's lives here on earth and love our neighbor as ourselves. But this life is not all that there is. Ultimately, our goal is to make sure that everybody gets to heaven and remove any obstacle that would keep someone from going to heaven. And if it may be the malicious hatred in the racist heart, we must remove that. If it's the despair from someone who's the victim of racism, we must remove that. And it's the light of Christ that will help us to be able to do that. And so I hope you'll take that light and give a fair look at these different issues related to racism. And I'm sure maybe the conversation will come up again. And maybe if someone disagrees with me about what I've said in this episode, I would encourage you not to simply say, oh, Trent Horn's a racist. That's just self-defeating. That's just, if I am a racist after all of this, there are so many people, if they hear you say that, so many people who will just give up at trying to combat the sin of racism. If you disagree with me, that's fine. I'm human. I could be wrong about some of these things. And maybe I could have a dialogue with someone about some of these issues. And that's always a good thing for us to do, have charitable, open, and fair dialogue. So, hey, hope this is a helpful resource. I'll post some recommended resources on the subject at trendhornpodcast.com. Be sure to go and check it out. And be sure to support us at trendhornpodcast.com to be able to keep these videos being produced. And click like and subscribe if you're watching on YouTube. Hey, thank you guys so much. And I hope you have a really blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.